Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds. And we have a new Time magazine today, so I will be reading you the cover stories. And our cover story is The Making of the Pope. Pope Leo, How a Kid from the Midwest Became the Leader of the Catholic Church. And this is by Belinda Luscombe in Chicago. Part 1. I'm ticked, says John Prevost, the retired Midwestern high school principal who is now abruptly and without warning globally famous and in demand. I didn't want to be, but I'm so angry. He's sitting at the table of Denise and Bob Utter, who have invited a bunch of people from their local Catholic parish about 45 minutes south of Chicago to talk about their friend and John's kid brother Bob, whom they have known for decades, over pizza. Sometimes they call him Father Bob. Occasionally, they remember to call him by his new name, Pope Leo XIV, but it's unfamiliar to their tongue. One of the guests accidentally calls him Pope Pius. It's probably not all fun and games to be the spiritual leader of 1.4 billion people from very different cultures, at a time when the Catholic Church is recovering from multiple scandals, riven from within, financially and snarled, and especially in the so-called developed nations, wrestling with a growing disinterest in the stuff that it does best, ancient ritual, obligatory gatherings, and biblical exegesis. But it's also a teensy bit of a drug to be his brother. Pope Leo XIV, 69, is the person to whom lots of people look when they want to come to contact, into contact with God. John Prevost, 71, is the person to whom they look when they want to reach the Pope. His mailbox is inundated. A local accounting firm sent him a 30-page pitch deck on how it would sort out the Vatican's finances. Another opportunist sent him two baseballs, asking for them to be forwarded to His Holiness, newly anointed as the world's most famous White Sox fan. Dear Mr. Prevost, please have your brother sign these baseballs, the accompanying letter said, according to its recipient. You can keep one and run a fundraiser. His mail carrier is sympathetic, advising him to hire someone to handle the paper blizzard. It's not just mail. His phone, a landline, rings well into the night. On one recent warm day, Prevost was watering his yard when he noticed people at his front door. It was congregants from a now shuttered church in Chicago, Adalbert's. They had a two-page letter to send to the Pope in the hopes that he will convince the cardinal to reopen the church, and they're not going to give up, he says. Even Hollywood is getting in on the act. Prevost has already had a showbiz publicist offer to represent him, and a journalist stop by twice to interview him and give him tips on what it is imprudent to say on live TV, such as his imminent travel plans. Prevost travails are one of the many ripple effects of May 8, 2025, when the conclave made several types of history by handing the papal keys to a recently appointed American cardinal, Robert Francis Prevost. Is not only the first Augustinian, the first modern missionary, and the first devotee of Pepys and Hostess Snowballs to occupy the throne of St. Peter. He's also the first leader from a land where opportunism and entrepreneurship are admired only slightly less than the triune God. America is not used to having a local guy as the driving force of an institution with four times as much history and an even greater capacity to inspire fear and awe. But a deep dive into Pope Leo's education and background shows that either by divine intervention, wise choices, luck, or all three, his path made him uniquely prepared for steering through the choppy waters facing the ancient denomination that he now leads. As recently as 3 months ago, it was a truth universally acknowledged that there was not going to be a pope from the United States anytime soon. The Americans were too dominant elsewhere, too loud, too confident, too greedy, too obsessed with individual liberties. They generated the new and the shiny, preferring novel and homegrown faiths to the traditions of Europe and Asia. They were more concerned with LGBTQ rights and the ordination of women than the plight of the poor and dispossessed. But if ever there was going to be an American pope, people could have predicted he'd come from the Midwest. "He's Midwestern nice," says Father Paul Galletto, the pastor of St. Paul Church in Philadelphia, of the fellow Augustinian that he has known since his 20s. "He listens to you. He's pleasant. He's not going to jump in the middle of your conversation and tell you that you're wrong. That is a great advantage for him." Even the much prevailed upon prevost can't stay ticked for long. A few evenings before our dinner, someone left a package at his doorstep. It was a Wordle cap. He plays Wordle with his Vatican-based brother every day. He in English, the Pope in Italian. And then here comes the card. "Dear John, in a world where there are too many evil people right now, you are a breath of fresh air. Thank you," says Prevost. We so appreciate your sense of humor and your kind words. And that changed my attitude. People are watching me, so I better not be crabby." It was clear from early on where the youngest of Mildred and Louis Prevost's three sons was heading. The only thing that was in question until eighth grade was, would it be an order priest or would it be a diocesan priest, says John. The former belongs to a brotherhood, while the latter serves a church. Nothing was forced on him. That was his decision to make. The family were eager Catholics. His mother, a school librarian, sang in the choir, as did young Robert. They had relatives who were nuns. Before he became high school principal and district superintendent, Lewis, who served in the Navy during World War II, had considered being a priest. His son's career choices mirrored their father's. Lewis, the oldest, named after his dad, went into the Navy. John was a principal of Catholic high schools, and Robert took the path that his father might have taken. Apart from his devotion to the church and the fact that study came easily to him, Robert was a regular kid, riding his bike around the streets of the South Chicago working-class suburb of Dalton by day, paying flashlight tag by night, and occasionally squeezing the gluing goo out of fireflies and wiping it on an older brother. It didn't seem odd that he occasionally set up a pretend communion table on the ironing board and gave his family play sacraments. John confirms that even while very young, Robert had a reputation among the neighbors, with one elderly lady telling him as they played in the yard that he'd be Pope one day. When young men showed an inclination toward entering the priesthood in 1967 Chicago, a city that was Catholic enough that locals identified themselves by their parish rather than their neighborhood, they'd be visited by representatives of the various orders, football scout style, to see whether they might fit in. I remember sitting around a table each time someone was coming. And they would come, and then everyone would ask questions, says John Prevost. We had to sit there and be nice. The vocational director, who persuaded 8th grade Robert to give the Augustinians a spin, was Dudley Day, a Catholic of the old school, whose views were conservative enough that he later parted ways with his local church over a disagreement about modernization. St. Augustine, the minor seminary in Holland, Michigan, where Robert Prevost completed his secondary education, was the kind of place that sorted the priests from the merely pious. About 50 boys were accepted every year, and about a dozen graduated 4 years later. It was tough, it was rigorous, says Father Beckett Franks, who was a year above the future pope in school. Students were up at 6 a.m., had scheduled activities until about 8:30 p.m., when they had a few hours of free time before retiring to a large dormitory lined with beds. There was prayer three times a day and a lot of time in close quarters together. Prevost, who was co-valedictorian and yearbook editor, among other accolades, had a reputation for being a good person to turn to for help with homework, especially math or languages. "He was the smartest person I think we ever met," says Franks, who is now a Benedictine monk and chaplain. He had mastered French by the middle of high school. Students were required to undertake certain extracurricular activities. Prevost was in the choir with Franks, both sing tenor, and play tennis to keep up their academic performance, but mostly the school's focus was how to live in community. Everything that we went through at St. Augustine Seminary High School prepared Robert Prevost for his position, says Franks. Not just education, but dealing with people and learning patience and how to behave. From Michigan, Prevost went to Villanova, the Augustinian University just outside Philadelphia. It was in Pennsylvania that he really developed his love of driving, which, according to two contemporaries, he would do while reading a book. He and three friends once asked Father Bill Sullivan, who oversaw would-be friars, if they could drive to a church dance in Chicago, some 12 hours away, and be back by the following afternoon. In January, their request was declined. "He was just an easy guy to be with," says Sullivan, now a parochial vicar at St. Jude's, the church that the Utters belong to in New Lenox, Illinois. "He made friends. People really listened to him. Prevost majored in math and minored in philosophy, but it was pretty much the end of his study of anything not directly related to his faith." In September 1977, shortly after he finished coursework at Villanova, he made the first round of vows to join the Augustinian order. At 22, Robert Prevost was committing his life to an establishment in the midst of generational change. The Catholic Church of his parents had been altered profoundly by the Second Vatican Council, which released a series of reports in the mid-60s, loosening up some of the church's strictures and establishing a series of new procedures and rules that allowed, among other things, Mass to be said in languages that were not Latin and pastoral care for those who are divorced. One result of these changes was a call for a new style of urban and more ecumenical Catholic university. Prevost joined an institution founded on these principles. The Catholic Theological Union, CTU, housed in the former Aragon Hotel, was a decade old when Prevost arrived. Two dozen or so men's orders studied there, as well as women and lay people, and the school had female professors and a rabbi on staff. What it didn't have was any students on the way to becoming diocesan priests. They trained in the more palatial Mundelein Seminary outside Chicago. The mix of cultures, genders, and orders, and the shedding of hierarchy, professors were called by their first names, made it an exciting place to be. It was, in a certain sense, the best of what religious community had become, says Sister Diane Bergant, 88, who taught there for 45 years. Bergant marveled at the opportunities that she was given. "This is going to sound like an exaggeration. but I don't remember being minimized by any male colleagues because I was a woman, she says. Women were considered to be theologians in the same way as men. She had Prevost in two classes, Old Testament and Pentateuch, and doesn't remember him at all. But you can tell from her class notes that he did well and always turned in the assignments on time. Each student had a spiritual director, and Prevost chose Sister Lynn Osik, who also supervised his theological reflection class. Calm and steady, says Osik. Those are the two words that I would say about him. It was just like nothing fazed him. He was really a person who was at peace with himself. At the end of the day, students from a religious order went back to the houses of their communities where professors from the order also lived and dined and prayed with them. About a dozen Augustinians lived together in the St. John Stone Friary in Hyde Park, with others coming and going. While it is safe to say it was collegial, it was not one of the party houses. Sometimes we were invited up to different parts of the building where the other communities were to celebrate various things, says Prevost's classmate, Father Mark Francis, now Superior General of the Viatorians. The Passionists, for example, would always have a Kentucky Derby Day, and the Precious Blood always had kegs of beer. Bergant confirms this. Those Precious Blood men put on good parties. The St. John Stone Friary has been in the news over the years because a priest accused of abusing at least 13 minors was allowed to move in there in 2000. A victims group filed a complaint with the Vatican in March, alleging that Prevost endangered the safety of children by allowing the priest to live near an elementary school. To our knowledge, Pope Leo XIV has acted in accordance with church policies in every abuse case, the Archbishop of Society of Chicago. The Archbishop of Chicago said in a statement in May, and has consistently expressed his compassion for survivors of this crime and sin. A lawyer for Midwest Augustinians has suggested that the location was selected because of the supervision the priest would receive. The complaint also alleged that Prevost failed to properly handle three women's claims of sexual abuse while he was a bishop in Peru in 2022. The Vatican has said Prevost followed church protocol and sent the results of an initial investigation to Rome. The Vatican closed its own investigation in August 2023, though the diocese later reopened the case. The scholarship at CTU was both rigorous and progressive. One of the required classes on Christology had two versions, one taught by a professor trained by Edward Schillebleck, the respected Belgian theologian who promulgated the idea that the true role of the Christian was not to ascribe to a certain set of beliefs, but to right injustice as Jesus did. And the other, trained by the equally respected German theologian Karl Rahner, whose emphasis was on the mystical nature of Christ and thus of all humans. We were not trained in a very doctrinaire, rigid kind of theology, says Francis, who served a stint as CTU's president. One of the strengths of the school was the missiological part. The question of religion and culture was very important in terms of how we have to recalibrate things if you're moving from one group to another, one culture to another. Many of CTU's graduates became missionaries, including one of Prevost's contemporaries, Ezekiah Rahman, who was murdered in 1985 in Brazil as he tried to broker peace between the corporate landowners and the local landless farmers. There is a campaign to have him beatified. Bishop Daniel Turley, who lived in the Augustinian Friary a few months in the late 70s, remembers Prevost as being particularly committed to the idea of doing missionary work. In general, the Augustinians are considered a missionary order who teach and preach. St. Augustine left Europe and moved to North Africa with a handful of other devotees who lived out a life saturated by their beliefs while also absorbed in the needs of their neighbors. Augustinians don't stay in one place, like the Benedictines, but move around, bringing their gifts to different places, but always among other Augustinians. The current Pope once described the order as brothers and friends whose lives and witnesses truly make a difference. Wherever Prevost has gone, he has been among men who have been trained as he was and committed to sharing everything. Even when he was a cardinal with his own papal apartment, he went to the Augustinian Curia for meals and mass every day, and once a week to play tennis. He dined there at least twice in the early weeks of his papacy. He was very interested in what I was doing in Peru, says Turley, who worked there for 52 years. While other students were heading to their rooms to study, Prevost wanted to talk about what people in Turley's diocese needed. Of all of them, he was the most community-minded, says Turley. If Prevost spent most of his first quarter century less than 800 miles from his home, the decades that followed would take him quite a bit farther. After he graduated from CTU and took his solemn vows in 1981, he was invited to study canon law in Rome. The Americans had stopped going to study in Rome, says Galletto, who was one of the first to return. We thought American theology was better and more modern. It wasn't based on patristics, but more on psychology and sociology. When he arrived with Robert Dodaro, his co-valedictorian from way back in high school, neither speaking Italian, Galletto was their guide. John Paul II, now Saint John Paul II, had just been elected, a youngish Polish pope emerging at the same time as Lech Walesa's Polish trade union Solidarity. There was this electric feel, says Galletto. Large crowds were coming to the audiences. While Prevost was studying history and doctrinaire subjects, essentially the legal framework for the Catholic Church's operations, at the Angelicum, a 440-year-old school where John Paul II had also studied, he was surrounded by the excitement of a new era. The Augustinian house was across St. Peter's Square from the Vatican, and it was filled with men from around the world. Galletto remembers Prevost really enjoying the global nature of the brotherhood. When you study in Rome, you realize that the church really is universal, says Galletto. Many of the Augustinians who are in the United States, we just think of the American problems that are the church's problems, but there is so much more than that. Because of his legal expertise, Prevost was asked to become personal secretary to a bishop in Chulalongkorn in northern Peru. But he arrived in the aftermath of the deadly El Nino floods and set to work helping rebuild the region. When you're a missionary, you just learn how to do everything from electronics to auto mechanics, said then-Cardinal Prevost during a visit to St. Jude's last year. It was not a seamless process. There might still not have been an American pope if one of Prevost's Augustinian brethren hadn't saved him from being electrocuted with a well-aimed tackle on a roof after the young missionary picked up the wrong two wires. While Pope Leo owes his formal education almost solely to the Northern Hemisphere, much of his shaping as a practitioner occurred in Peru. Those are the life experiences that give you life to continue on, that nourish you, says Turley, who was Prevost's superior when he arrived. As a young priest, to go through that and see how beautiful it is, how poor people can be, and yet all of the goodness and the power of people when they come together, and the wonderful things that they can do if you start breaking down prejudices and division, Prevost said as much at St. Jude's. The part of ministry that most shaped my life is Peru. After a decade in South America, it must have been quite an adjustment to take on the role of head of his home Augustinian province, which stretches throughout the Midwest and into Canada. One of his duties as provincial prior was to minister to the Augustinian schools, and he was called in to help out St. Rita of Cassia High School in Chicago. The students have a retreat every year, and the school likes to invite priests who are unfamiliar to the boys to hear confession so they don't feel awkward. In 2000, Prevost was one of those priests. I had gone to confession several times before, but it was like, 2 minutes, let me get out of here as quickly as I can, says Patrick P.J. McCarthy. But this was more of just a conversation. The two sat knee to knee in the darkened room and talked about underage drinking and sibling rivalry, among other things. He was not judging me, and he was just very open, recalls McCarthy. Mike Storsky, who was on the retreat as a student leader, noticed right away that Prevost was different from most priests. What was so fascinating about him was that almost immediately we forgot that he wasn't with us the whole time. He was so welcoming and so caring for what we were doing. After 2 years, Prevost was voted in as the head or prior general of all Augustinians, based again in Rome. He traveled a lot, encouraging the other 2,800 or so Augustinian friars around the world. But priors general can serve only 2 terms, and in 2013, Prevost found himself back in Chicago, back at CTU, helping guide Augustinians in training work usually done by much younger men. It's like having the CEO of an international organization retire from being CEO, but yet be employed by the organization for passing out mail, says Burgant, the Old Testament scholar. If Prevost felt it was a come down, he said nothing to his friends, but that's the Father Bob that the folks of New Lenox talk about, never too busy or too big for his community. Father Mike Schweffler had a heart transplant on Easter in 2005. The women of St. Jude's were looking after him, struggled to get his brethren to visit. But Prevost, who was prior general, came several times. Sometimes he was just on a stopover, and he drove here from O'Hare for a few hours, or just a few minutes, says Denise Utter. And then he'd go back to O'Hare because he had a connecting flight. At the same time, Prevost's friends want to make it clear that he's not overly reverent. He laughed when they showed him Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update segment about his election on YouTube. When they get together for pizza, his favorite is mushroom and sausage, we mostly don't talk about faith things at all, says Utter. Lisa Salava and her husband Rich visited Prevost in Rome in 2011, and he took them through a back door to St. Peter's Basilica for Mass so that they emerged right under the altar. When I walked up that spiral staircase, I looked up and I went, Jesus Christ, says Salava. And he goes, that's a good reaction. The current Pope also knows his way around a good, clean Midwestern joke, at least according to his brother. One of the latest jokes that he told Pope Francis was about going to the doctor because his arm hurt in 2 places, says John Provost. And the Pope said, really, what did the doctor say? And Bob said, the doctor said, well, don't go to those places. Prevost's return to Chicago also turned out to be something of a stopover because in 2014, Francis, whom Prevost had met when the late Pope Pontiff was still Archbishop Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Buenos Aires, asked him to return to Peru, this time as Bishop of Chiclayo, a large metropolis in the north. The diocese was dominated by clerics who were members of Opus Dei, a very conservative sect of Catholicism, and prevost, who had to become a Peruvian citizen to become a bishop, was charged with moving it back to the middle. So you had some resistance to the new bishop, says Turley. But those Opus Dei adherents who were in control quickly lost control because the people really wanted someone who was open and welcoming. The challenges weren't only from within the church. Right after he became a bishop, we had the tremendous problem of Venezuela, says Turley, who oversaw the Catholic Church's response to the 1.5 million asylum seekers accepted into Peru after the Venezuelan economy and civil society began to collapse in 2014. They needed housing, jobs, and medical help. One of the best bishops to work with in dealing with migrants was none other than Bishop Robert Prevost, says Turley. His diocese was so well organized to take care of them. The combination of Prevost's formal but reformist education and long fieldwork among people with very little but with each other to insulate them from hardship was perhaps what drove Pope Francis to swiftly raise his standing in the Vatican as the pontiff saw the dying of the light. In Hope, Francis's last book, he wrote that for the church to grow, it had to focus less on conversion and more on attracting people through the way that Christians, the way that Christians lived, and therefore, for high-ranking church officials, the title of servant, here in the sense of ministry, should obscure that of eminence. In 2023, Prevost was made a cardinal and moved back to the Vatican City, working in successively more prominent roles until the announcement of his election in May. He's been formed in the kind of church that is forward-thinking, missionary in its outlook, globally aware, and then, especially in Peru, very deeply formed by his accompaniment of people who were the poorest, says Sister Barbara Reed, the current president of CTU. You can hear it in everything he says. For many, it may be hard to believe that the Catholic Church has any relevance today. All those ornate, empty buildings with men in robes, waving smoke around elderly congregants, preaching homilies with reference to activities as quaint as shepherding and sewing, and praying to dead saints whose miracles are now forgotten or considered dubious. The first American pope officially comes from the province of Our Mother of Good Counsel, which seems almost as fantastical as coming from the Gladden Fields of Middle Earth. The church of his childhood, St. Mary of the Assumption, is abandoned, its stained glass windows, once displaying the papal keys, uncontemplated. But every time one expression of faith dies, another one seems to rise up, offering something more in keeping with the needs of the era. History records the first Pope Leo as an adept diplomat. He's credited with persuading Attila the Hun not to sack Rome. The current Pope Leo has already offered Russian leader Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky a place to negotiate in the wake of the United States bombing of Iran. He urged world leaders to stop the tragedy of war before it becomes an irreparable abyss. When Galletta saw his fellow Augustinian step into the balcony, he paused for a moment to reflect on the mysterious ways of the universe. We started at the same place 40 years ago. Here I am, stapling papers together at a parish because we're having a prayer service, he says, and he's going to be talking to Putin about the war in Ukraine. God had a plan for him, and God had a plan for me. Bob Prevost might never climb behind the wheel of a car again, but Pope Leo may be able to drive something. Already inquiries about becoming an Augustinian novitiate are up fivefold from last year. Augustinian websites have been flooded with traffic, and another type of visitor has been showing up on John Prevost's doorstep. People who feel that an American Pope is a sign. Because of my brother, they are going to go back to the church, says the older Prevost. They say, I've been away for a long time, and I'd like to come back. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds, and we're continuing now with the cover stories from this week's Time magazine. And the next one is The Most Influential Digital Voices. And the first one is Kai Cenat. Kai Cenat is whipping a golf cart across the University of Akron campus on Memorial Day weekend, furiously honking his horn, gaining ground on a trio of students who have cut class and are fleeing his wrath. Within seconds, he's cornered them and shakes a fistful of keys in their faces. My office, lunchtime, he spits. Over the next few days, Cenat will roam around campus corralling other troublemakers, mediating disputes, fixing tech issues, and delivering supplies. None of this is real, per se. Every day, Cenat wakes up and creates his own reality. He has no real authority over these students, who are actually among his best friends. This is Streamers University, a four-day content creator fantasy come to life, and Cenat is both an organizer and star. With 18 million followers, the 23-year-old is, by many metrics, the most popular performer on the Amazon-owned streaming platform Twitch. He entertains his audience by acting out improvised skits, playing video games, delivering monologues about music and fashion, and interviewing pop culture icons. Teens love him because his content is both relatable and aspirational. He's tuned in to having fun in his Atlanta house into a multi-million dollar empire. And his influence reaches far beyond his fan base. He coined the term Riz, Gen Z slang for romantic appeal, which Oxford named the word of 2023. Rappers seeking his approval come to his house to premiere songs. Cenat reports that when he criticized Drake's Nokia music video, Drake offered Cenat the chance to direct one for him. Streamers are most often associated with teens playing video games in their parents' basements, but Cenat has helped turn the medium into a formidable hybrid of talk show, interactive game show, and reality TV. He is streaming's first major crossover act and his shepherd into an ever-widening future, bringing his brand of wide-eyed enthusiasm and manic comedy influenced by black comedic traditions from Richard Pryor's wry commentary to Kevin Hart's self-deprecation to mainstream cultural events like the Met Gala and the Grammys. This July, he and his friends in the Creation Collective AMP are streaming 24/7 out of NBA Hall of Famer Tony Parker's Texas mansion. Some, especially older onlookers, find Cenat and his ever-growing flock of imitators distasteful or even dystopian. They see a man subjecting himself in a Truman Show spectacle of mindless distraction and constant surveillance, breeding a generation of narcissistic imitators. Streamers, on the other hand, don't understand why polite society puts up with jobs that all but suck the fun out of living, and coastal gatekeepers who control the pipeline's fame. Cenat is exemplifying an increasingly popular worldview that if you work hard enough on social media, you can sell your life as an entertainment product, which leads to a better life, which leads to a better product, and so on. We're showing people that if you be yourself, people are going to F with you, he says. And Senna tells this to Time. As a streamer, you're not in a box. You're not trapped. You can talk however you want. This year, Goldman Sachs estimated there are 67 million current creators globally, forming multi-hundred-billion-dollar industries that is taking an increasingly large bite out of digital advertising, commerce, and consumers' subscription budgets. Senate earns at least $6 a month from each of his subscribers, who differ from followers in that they pay to view his content without ads, and pockets 50% to 70% of the total, according to his manager. With a consistent subscriber base of more than 100,000 people, that adds up to at least $3.6 million a year through his stream. On top of that, he has inked lucrative deals with brands like Nike, McDonald's, and State Farm. Streaming University is Senate's most ambitious performance yet. He's gathered 130 creators on campus to create content together in hopes of collecting growing their audience. Students whose digital flights, housing, and new tech equipment are all paid for by Senet and brand deals are here to flirt, feud, party, and learn from the best, and live on camera, of course. On the first day, outside the university hall, despite efforts to conceal the event's location, dozens of children from all over the region and behind police barricades screaming the names of their idols. I've been watching Kai my whole life. I fall asleep watching him. I wake up watching him, says Amarion McCormick, a 12-year-old from Akron. He wants to follow in streamers' footsteps. They just do crazy stuff that I want to do, but I can't because I'm a kid still. One reason Senate's fan base loves him so much is his humble beginnings. As a child in the Bronx and later in Atlanta, Senate and his family bounced in and out of shelters as his Trinidadian immigrant mother hustled to make ends meet. I didn't digest it, but it was just confusing in terms of just having to move around a lot, he said of his homelessness. I would go to school, and nobody knew. Senate was never a good student. He faced disciplinary actions and often struggled to read. He thinks he has dyslexia. I wasn't as smart as all the other kids, he says. He preferred to spend his time playing games like Black Ops 2 or NBA 2K and watching YouTube. He posted his first video at 16 in 2018, and was soon creating content that ranged from album reactions to pranks, sometimes getting in trouble for recording at school. During college at SUNY Morrisville, he spent hours a day recording, editing, and uploading videos to a growing fan base on YouTube. Then the pandemic arrived in 2020, shutting down his campus. Senate eventually decided to drop out and commit to content creation, a timely move. Many kids were stuck at home and seeking entertainment and connecting. As Hollywood productions shut down and releases slowed, video games filled the void, as did the antics of influencers on social media, all of which boosted the popularity of Twitch, and young viewers loved it, because streamers were constantly on, spoke to them uncensored, and reflected genuine youth culture. 20 or 30 years ago, you couldn't actually connect to your favorite actors. The only time you could see Leonardo DiCaprio or Brad Pitt was when interviews happened or movies came out, says Deshae Frost, a 24-year-old streamer. Now you can see your favorite person eat when they wake up and what they like to watch. The difference is that vulnerability, that mysterious act, has gone away. Over the span of March 2020 to 2021, Twitch grew 80%. The platform now hosts 5 million streamers who are watched by 100 million viewers a month, resulting in more than 20 billion hours of content watched in 2024, the company says. With TikTok and Instagram Reels, a lot of that is transient. You're scrolling through the endless river of videos, says Nathan Grayson, author of Stream Big with Twitch. It's an all-encompassing thing where you're spending hours a day watching them and you're doing a lot of your socializing there. It's a cultural nexus point, and it's where a lot of the trends are generated. For many kids, Twitch has supplanted older forms of media. Kids don't really watch TV anymore, or if they do, it's because a Twitch streamer or YouTuber is also watching it and dissecting it. Senate is not always the funniest, most suave, or smartest person on Twitch, but he tends to be the most consistent, the most creative, and the most energetically relentless, willing to do whatever it takes for eyeballs. His first big moment was when viewers clocked a rodent running across his bedroom floor. The chat exploded with insults and then glee when Senate shrieked and fielded mock phone calls. "All the attention was on me," he now reminisces happily. One viral moment does not make a career, so Senate forged ahead, creating Youth Basketball League, appearing in a McBeast game show, streaming uninterrupted for days, showering with swim trunks on, and sleeping on camera, and hooking bigger and bigger names as guests like John Cena and LeBron James. Senate's social battery is undying, or at least it appears to be. In an off-camera interview, he shows a calmer, more introspective side. "I'll be really tired and drained," he admits. "It's a mindset thing, though. I can be as physically tired as I want, but in my mind, if I say, just keep going, I'm going to just keep going." His desire for constant growth and attention has sometimes backfired. When Senate staged a promised giveaway of gaming items in New York City in 2023, the crowd that showed up caused a riot and over $50,000 in damages. Senate paid restitution and apologized, and Manhattan prosecutors dropped their charges. "I just want you people to know it wasn't my intention to start a riot," Senate says, sounding sheepish. But the news and the articles will never put out great things. I will always be controversial or bad. These days, Senate gets more press for his increasingly ambitious streaming productions. For Mafiathon 2 in November, Senate streamed for 30 straight days, culminating in a wild 10-hour session in which he and the comedians Kevin Hart and Drewski navigated exploding turkeys, pick up basketball with LeBron James's son, and a group portraying the Addams Family. All in all, the marathon garnered 50 million viewers, reportedly making over $3 million in revenue. Senate invests in production value because he feels he's directly competing with platforms Netflix. "If people pay for my subscription to get no ads, I want to make sure it's a movie every single time. Sennett conceived of Streamer University, and it unfolded in waves of uproarious, bawdy chaos. Attendees recorded posse rap songs, became entangled in love triangles, formed sororities, and roved the dorm hallways in gangs, flinging bags of flour and shooting each other with water guns filled with fart spray. Sennett orchestrated a whole story arc in which Streamers sneaked off campus to go party, and then, pretending to be furious, shut it down. While Sennett feigned rage for show, he spent much of the event in a real panic, tending to small crises. Room keys didn't work, equipment was lost, room assignments were bungled, and interlopers kept trying to sneak past the police. Something that I'm noticing within myself that I just discovered is I have anxiety, Sennett says. I'm always worrying. Oh God, what if things don't go right? I'm scared. Anxiety runs deep in streaming communities. They need to be constantly on. The sense of competition and the stress of constant surveillance caused many Streamer University attendees to break down in tears. People wanted to go home. People were crying, Sennett says. My job was to let them know, do not give up. There's a lot of people that would want to be in your spot, so keep going. Some streamers have pushed themselves to unhealthy ends in order to increase their numbers. A YouTube called Normie spent months locked inside a closet, eating only when viewers sent him $10. Another creator, Emily, has been streaming for 3 years straight, weathering insults and harassments from strangers. Parental groups and mental health advocates are alarmed. I worry about kids not living life for themselves and not developing a sense of self, says Sarah Adams, an online child safety advocate. Every aspect of their day, including sleep, is now a performance for external validation and likes and gifts. To Sennett, the benefits outweigh the costs. And he wants to be known as someone who holds the door open for others. One student, who now has a devoted fan base of his own, says, he gave me a whole life. Ray says, made by Kai Sennett, that's me. As Sennett's influence and bankroll grow, he is mulling how best to make an impact on the world. Last year, he used his Marathon 2 stream to raise money to build a school in Nigeria, and he wants to undertake more philanthropic efforts. His next step may be Hollywood, but true to the philosophy that undergirds streaming, he envisions making an entrance on his own terms. The success of Streamer University, which yielded 27 million hours of viewing on Twitch alone, has emboldened him to think about what it would be like to conceptualize, fund, and organize a movie-grade production without having to go through the film industry's front door. Usually, you go to Hollywood with some idea and hope that people fund it, he says. But I don't have to do that. I want to be the person running it and putting my money into it independently until people start coming to me. And folks, that does it for Time Magazine for today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.